Hello, Curious Serious listeners. This is your co-host, Emma. Today, we're excited to talk to John Dean, who's a postdoc fellow in the Brain Mechanisms of Pain and Health Lab at UC San Diego. We've got a fascinating conversation to share with you all today. While John is now surfing on the weekends and finding clinical applications to DMT in his research lab, this interview will spotlight how the paths to our current destinations are rarely linear and at times unforeseen from our view at the start. That being said, we'll start by covering his academic journey through his bachelor's in chemistry at Youngstown State University to his master's and PhD in molecular and integrative physiology at the University of Michigan. Then we'll get into his hiatus from academia to pursue his dreams as a signed band member and how music, creativity, and compassion led him to his current pursuit in understanding how different psychoactive substances can impact our perception of pain. And finally, we'll close up with some personal advice from John about trusting your gut and finding a promising mentor and lab for research-focused careers. Check out our timestamps in the description for a more detailed breakdown of today's interview. Curious to Serious is Psychedelic Grad's podcast where we interview students and professionals in the psychedelic space to better understand how they navigated their path from being curious about psychedelics to wanting to dedicate their careers to psychedelics. This podcast wouldn't be here without MAPS, whose support has allowed us to keep the online Psychedelic Grad community platform free for all members and publish these epic conversations. So without further ado, here's John Dean.
Hi, John. Welcome to Curious to Serious.
Hi, thanks. Happy to be here. I'm in California, so I'm at the University of California, San Diego, and doing a postdoc out here. And I got here last November, so almost a year now. And I came from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I was doing my PhD. And that PhD was in physiology. And the postdoc is sort of transitioning the more molecular work that I did in non-human animal studies, rodent studies, to the clinical human neuroimaging realm. I mean, it sounds so boring, but it's kind of fun.
No, I think anyone hearing about neuroimaging in rodents would be fascinated to learn more about what that experience is like. You hadn't had experience learning how to do that prior to your postdoc, right?
No, not with fMRI. Or anything like that. I had a little bit of experience in between my undergraduate degree, which was, I did that in Ohio. It was just where I'm from. And I did that degree in chemistry. And then before I went to Ann Arbor to start my graduate work, I was actually involved in this music program where we were teaching autistic children how to sort of play the drums. And it was like a kinesthetic program that really integrated music into the classroom to try to help with arithmetic and reading skills and even social skills and things of that nature. And then we also did a lot of surveys to track the progress of the students in the program. And we even looked at melatonin levels in relation to the music program, because in autistic populations, melatonin levels are very low. So we were just interested to see if maybe there was a biomarker that would also correlate with healthy outcomes and music and things like that. Because there was also some work in Alzheimer's that showed that the memory deficits and things of that nature correlated with the lower melatonin levels. So yeah, so I had a tiny little bit of experience with the human clinical trials and that sort of thing, but yeah, that was a really good time. It was really cool to be involved in the music program and help the kids out and learn from them and help teach them and all that good stuff. So
it sounds so fascinating that you were a chemistry undergrad, and between undergrad and grad school at Michigan, you were working with special needs children and music, and then you later went on to study, you know, in graduate school physiology. So to hear about how all of those intersect with the work that you were doing and your own passion with music.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a big part of it, because I've been playing guitar for a long time. And yeah, so when I actually took a pretty extended break in between my junior and senior year of undergrad extended being like, what, like 6 years. So to just be a musician, if I guess that's what you would call it. And yeah, just like, you know, travel and play music, and also was instructing guitar for a long time too. Yeah. So when I went back to finally finish the undergraduate degree, it was sort of just something that came natural to try to combine all those ideas and a way that would be beneficial to some people.
And when you were at Michigan studying physiology, you also co-founded the Psychedelic Neuroscience and Therapy Group. What's the origin story there?
Yeah, that was recent, actually. So I'm still involved with that, even from UCSD, but that's mainly run by my colleagues and graduate student buddies there, mainly Nick Linos and Nick Dename. But yeah, it's so we had just, it came from the idea that there was a group on campus that was doing like a neuroscience-based seminar series that was funded through the graduate school. So we thought we'd take a stab and apply for the funding to do one that was based on psychedelic neuroscience and therapy. And that was just a lot of the grad students, that all my friends, that we were all like, hey, there's some stuff that's starting to pop up at Michigan. We're all involved in some way, shape, or form in psychedelic science. So we wanted to try to bridge it with all sorts of other departments on campus that were doing it. So the goal with that was to really stretch it and not be, I mean, we wanted to keep it like in the realm of neuroscience because that's what we're all studying, but we also didn't want to be super closed-minded about it because, I mean, right, like understanding how psychedelics work certainly goes well beyond the realm of neuroscience. Yeah, so it's grown. I mean, and we still do monthly journal clubs and we try to make it active too. So it's not just like someone's reviewing a paper. We have speakers that have either published something recently or talk about some of their older work. Yeah. We've hosted a lot of great people. Like we've had like Alan Davis on there, Matthew Johnson, and yeah, it's been cool. And the social work community at Michigan too, the master's program there has been super active as well on campus with trying to launch some formal classes and things of that nature, and also get involved with some of the clinical stuff that's starting to launch at the University of Michigan. So we're just hoping to really tie all that together and just kind of build a community.
Yeah, and there was so much happening with D-Crim and Ann Arbor in general. And I think you were involved in that as well, weren't you?
I mean, a little bit. All the credit there goes to the people really like leading that charge, like Julie. But yeah, I mean, they engaged with us as well. And yeah, we supported the best we could. And you know, some of us also spoke alongside of that whole team with the city council and everything. Everything was really supportive in Ann Arbor. And they even just passed, I see, a entire month of like entheogen month in Ann Arbor. So yeah, Michigan's a great place for that stuff. And the community is starting to really get some footing. And yeah, a lot of great things are happening there.
Did you know that you were interested in research as an undergraduate studying chemistry, even when you had come back from your musician hiatus from university in the academic setting? Or was it something that you discovered along the way?
I think it was something I always knew was bound to happen at some point. So yeah, it was always there. But with the music thing, it just seemed like there was a much lower ceiling and a much shorter time frame to do it on. So like when the band I was in got a nice indie deal with this little label out of Cleveland. I mean, I'm the type of person that just, I don't waste time. I mean, it seems like I do if you look at my CV. But I mean, point being is, you know, when we got some money to go record in the studio, it was like, dude, there's no way I'm going to be able to like try to do the best job I can doing this and then also
take Orgo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those are the classes I was taking when that all happened, actually. So, yeah, but I mean, it was a lot of fun, like walking in as like, you know, in my late 20s into like a physical chemistry class after having not taken like a single chemistry course in 6 years. I was like, oh, sweet. This is going to go great. I remember I was in there and somebody dropped a beaker, and it's just like, I don't know if you're familiar with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but the scene where, well, so anyway, someone dropped a beaker and I was like, did you see what God just did to us, man? Like, it was just like blurted out of me because I just don't have a filter and I'm out of my mind. And yeah, like everybody looked at me like what?
It sounds like you were a character out of a Hunter S. Thompson book itself, you know, going out, leaving school, really being on the road, living your best life, playing guitar, traveling the country, and then coming on back to a chemistry class.
Oh, you know, like, I'm a character,
with the big beard coming in. He's like, yeah. Hey, everyone.
Yeah, I'm a cartoon for sure. I don't deny it. I embrace it at this point in my life.
Well, I asked if you had known early on if you were interested in research, because even with the, you know, the endeavors that you embarked through your life, there was always this, it sounds like there's this hint on curiosity or asking what if, or this next element of being interested in what can happen next. You're working with these children, you're having a beautiful time interacting with them, interacting with music, and then there's, what about melatonin? What about neuroimaging? What's happening here in the brain? How can we relate it to other things happening and bringing it even back to the body and somatic work and physiology? They all just sound like they were hinting at this very curious to serious element that we're talking about now.
Yeah, my interest was always and is still rooted in neurochemistry and neuropsychology. So it's been amazing to kind of get back into that, the psychology element of it, because I did start my undergrad as a psychology major. And then I realized that I was at that point in my life far more interested in the more like analytical chemistry element. And I actually really enjoyed organic chemistry a lot, which is what took me to get my chemistry major. I mean, honestly, like if there would have been opportunities like there are now in the field of psychedelic neuroscience and the chemistry realm, I may have went that route. I just always really enjoyed like synthetic organic chemistry. But anyhow, yeah, so that was always like the backbone, and just the idea that even something as what people would consider as trivial as like caffeine, how that can just alter consciousness and change just your whole perception of what you're doing. So that always just blew my mind, how your brain is just this receptor for all these different chemicals and receiver, and there's all these different neurotransmitters floating around. And then, you know, when I came to find that things like serotonin and melatonin were so molecularly similar to dimethyltryptamine, which is this insanely powerful psychedelic substance that was also found in trace amounts in the urine and the blood of mammals and humans and tons of plants. It was just like, wow, okay, well, why is that? maybe we should have a look at that. That seems interesting. But so yeah, that honestly, all of that kind of got me interested in neuroscience. And after I finished my chemistry degree, I realized that, yeah, I would need to kind of understand systems neuroscience a lot better than I currently did. And just going a straight chemistry route wasn't going to afford that to me if I was interested in really, ultimately, I was interested in translating things to clinical benefit, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're only here for a very short amount of time, right? So it's like, try to make a difference, right? And yeah, so I mean, that was kind of my long-term goal. And with the PhD, doing that at the University of Michigan, like right in the medical school, was really eye-opening, because it was placing me sort of at the intersection of the basic science being passed along into the translational realm. And now I'm sort of working toward the other side of that equation and being directly involved in the clinical studies. So though it's been not an easy path, kind of completely switching gears, more or less in the postdoc, it's been very rewarding and super grateful to be in the position that I am. And yeah, to be doing stuff that excites me to get to work every morning.
Glad to hear it. As you sip on your pineapple juice, Red Bull, and lime.
So California already, man. 9 months. That's all it took. I mean, if you could make a life in 9 months, you could turn me California in 9 months. Come on.
I guess for the audience listening, and also for myself now hearing more about your becoming into the field, how did you discern between choosing physiology or, you know, choosing neuropsychopharmacology or behavioral pharmacology or, you know, cognitive neuroscience? If you already had the element of chemistry a bit more solidified, you know, the microscopic mechanisms and that type of activity, you know, what made you want to choose physiology and or, you know, Michigan? Like, were those two things a direct choice? Just sounds like there were so many possibilities.
Right. Well, so I navigated, like I always do, just based on what I just said, like what is going to really, what are my passions and what's going to really get me to do my best work and keep me super excited and motivated, right? Because like academia is a grind, man, as everyone knows that's even somewhat involved in it, right? So you gotta love it. And every move that I've made has been based on the idea that, hey, this is something that I'm going to love doing, and it's going to get that 180% or whatever is required of me for academia to be successful out of me. So for Michigan, it was twofold. It was a great university, and you know, so I got accepted into their master's program. I didn't apply to that many places because I knew kind of really the work I wanted to get involved in. And there, I applied because of the work that was going on with endogenous DMT in Jima Borjigin's lab. And yeah, when I got accepted to the program, it was really a no-brainer. I was like, okay, great, great university, and exactly what I want to be doing, where really hardly any labs in the world are really looking at that. So yeah, it was a no-brainer to go there. But then in terms of the PhD, so since I had been involved with the physiology department before, because dude, when I took physiology as an undergrad, I was like, this is hard. It's like, it didn't come natural to me by any stretch of the imagination.
But organic, it did.
I mean, I don't know, because with organic chemistry, there was just like a couple major rules that you would follow, right? Or a couple major things going on. You know, it's like, oh, electronegativity kind of is so much, right? You can kind of solve all the puzzles with just a couple major concepts, which works well with my brain. Whereas with physiology, like when I first got into it, I was like, oh my God, it's like arrows everywhere. And like, you know, but
for all these weird names.
Yeah. So it wasn't by any means something that came easy to me, but I'm really glad that I was able to do a PhD in it, because it just made me think like a physiologist, which I didn't before. And just thinking in terms of how one little thing happening somewhere in your body can completely impact the entire system. And that's one of the big things that I got out of that, the study of physiology. And so I was pretty excited about the prospect of doing a PhD in it. And then the department there at Michigan was amazing and incredibly supportive throughout the master's program. And so, yeah, when I got the offer to remain there, yeah, it was kind of also another no-brainer. I did apply to some other places and did get some other offers, but staying there, and then there was the Center for Consciousness Science was just launching when I finished my master's there. And yeah, that was doing a ton of cool work in anesthesia and then eventually psychedelics. So a lot of that team is now leading forward the psychedelic work in Michigan.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like the lab and what the lab was researching at the university that you already liked drove quite a bit of your interest in navigating the master's program you were going to attend. Not as much the master's program directing the lab that you wanted to work at the university. Is there any word of advice you might have to anyone listening that might be thinking in the same creative path like yours?
I would say, hey, kids, if you know that you want to get a PhD, don't get a master's degree first. Because, yeah, you'll be in a lot of debt. But on that note, I was incredibly grateful and humbled to just recently be a recipient of an NIH award called the Loan Repayment Grant, helping me pay back my student loan debt, which is, yeah, it's substantial. So, no, but I mean, for real, if you, that would be my advice. Like, if you really are thinking that you may want to do a PhD, apply to all those programs and maybe forego a master's. You know, if you're uncertain, obviously maybe do the master's, but I mean, that would be the only advice I give, because like all the other stuff is kind of like, you know, it's subjective, right? Like what works for one person isn't going to work for everybody else. And what worked for me may not be, what worked for me probably isn't going to be how other people are going to do it, if I'm being honest. I'm a cartoon character, like I said. So if you want to end up in a Sunday comic strip, like, follow, but yeah, I don't know.
Heard it here on the Curious the Serious podcast.
Being neither curious nor serious.
So you also do some work with chronic pain and meditation.
Correct, yeah.
What is that like? How is it intersecting with some of the research you're doing, the other research you're doing right now with rodents? What is that experience like working at two different labs at once?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so yeah. So the rodent research I'm no longer doing, that was in my PhD. Yeah, right. So, oh, that's all good. Yeah, so sorry if I wasn't clear when we originally discussed this. But yeah, so the rodent research was all during my PhD. And then my goal was to transition what I learned in the rodent models to clinical work and human neuroimaging. And with pain, so when I was finishing up at Michigan, I met a professor there named Rick Harris, who is really big into meditation. And so he had a course that is being taught there on the neuroscience of meditation. And that actually got me, A, starting in a meditation practice, and then B, alerted me to the work of Fadl Zeidan, who I work with now at UCSD. And when I started reading into the literature on chronic pain, it became pretty clear that there's this really effective component to it. There's this emotional component to it, right? And that individuals that have chronic pain are experiencing their reality different than somebody who isn't having that chronic pain experience. So that really, so my PhD was looking at the role, one of the studies, because I was involved with the endogenous DMT research as well, but my main PhD work was looking at the role of the prefrontal cortex, or anterior, higher developed brain regions in consciousness. And we looked at arousal as sort of a surrogate for that. And So starting to work in chronic pain, there's also this component of prefrontal brain areas, especially with the meditation work that now I'm involved with. Mm-hmm. So finding that there's this cognitive component to it, and that activation of these frontal sort of reappraisal executive brain areas is actually a part of how meditation reduces acute pain. And now we have studies. And when I say acute pain, I mean pain administered in people that don't have chronic pain. So in that respect, healthy individuals. Mm-hmm. And then seeing in the scanner what happens when they meditate while they're getting this heat stimulus, like before and after their meditation practice. And even something as simple as like 4 meditation training sessions can drastically reduce the experience of pain in response to this heat probe. And so it's like a thermal stimulus that just heats up to like 48, 49 degrees Celsius. It doesn't burn the skin or anything like that. So it's a noxious stimulus. And that work now is being translated into chronic back pain populations to see if meditation will likewise be beneficial. And yeah, so I mean, that was a big draw for me. And coming to UCSD, it was huge to have that meditation backbone throughout everything and that mindfulness. And there's also a center for empathy and compassion here that does neuroscientific research on what is empathy and compassion. Can we, you know, what are some techniques to cultivate it? Can meditation be used? Can psychedelics be used? And so that whole culture here was a big draw. And to get training in neuroimaging on studies like meditation, and then the work that's starting soon with psilocybin for phantom limb pain, which over the past several months we've been getting that together and ready to launch. Yeah, it was, again, kind of one of those things where I was just like, yeah, this is the right decision to come here and pursue that, because I know that this is something that's going to really just keep me passionate and keep me moving.
100%. I mean, it really sounds like you're coming back to, you know, neurochemistry and physiology, even in the work that you're doing now. It's fascinating. Even with the meditation work, there are a couple of things that were brought up that I quickly jotted down. I was just interested that what you were talking about with the acute pain and, you know, the reaction after how 4 meditations, your reaction to pain decreases. Does that explain Wim Hof? Familiar with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I know the basics of, like, you know, what's implied and how it's done. I've never tried it personally. So, but it's extreme physiology is a lot of what that field is and what's going on. And I mean, I did recently read the PNAS paper that documented some of the studies on that technique. And yeah, I don't think that it's quite the same thing as, well, I don't know. I mean, it could be. So let me take that back. I mean, it needs to be studied, right? And compared is basically what needs to happen. And it, when you're looking at it from the neuroimaging perspective, to my knowledge, I don't think he's done that sort of thing in the scanner. It might be hard to do that because there's so much movement involved. But with EEG, I guess there has been some work with him. So that'd probably be the way mainly to go with that and to compare it to meditative states. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up. I mean, there's one of the things that my advisor always says is, you know, he's been doing this for decades, like meditation research. And you know, he's like, if it turns out to all be placebo, I'm fine. As long as it works, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I love that about him. He's just like, let's find out what's going on, the truth. And you know, if everything we thought is wrong, great, we've done our job regardless. But that being said, comparing mindfulness meditation, at least, to things like just focusing on the breath without that element of mindfulness or distraction or placebo, there are different neural correlates that are engaged, like different brain areas are engaged across those modalities. So there are differences. And comparing mindfulness to things like placebo, that though they are sort of all effective in reducing the pain, they do it by different mechanisms. And mindfulness in his studies was the most effective.
It sounds like your PI, is that who the mentor that you're speaking of as well? Sounds like he has like a great amount of influence, positive influence in your take on the research and work that you're doing right now. Can I want to ask, because you've had experience with other PIs in the past as well, do you think that working with someone that maybe has experience and actively practices mindfulness, do you think that helps build a stronger relationship between what they're working on and your relationship with them in the lab? Like, is there something really to be said about someone that's
your employer or your boss or a mentor that's actively practicing mindfulness and how that might affect your own mindfulness practices?
So, you know, I don't know if ironic is the right word. You know, the Alanis Morissette song comes to mind, which isn't, there's nothing really ironic in that song at all, right? Like, it's all just bad luck. But anyhow, so yeah, Google it. But so it's ironic a little bit because Fadl really doesn't practice that much anymore, if at all. I think he doesn't even practice at all. And like when COVID hit, like I got super into meditation, you know, was trying to do it as long as I could and really learn different ways to get into it for months. And then I was like, yeah, cool, I'll move to California. And like, I hardly ever meditate. And Fadl doesn't either. And I don't know. I mean, he says that it's almost like a hindrance, right? Because if you're constantly in that state, then you if you're maintaining that practice, it's not the most scientific thing in terms of like when you go to analyze the data, right? Because then in your head, you're like, oh yeah, this works for me, right? Like even if it's like a subconscious thing, even if you have the absolute best in scientific intention. So that, but that being said, obviously like the practice have and the experience having been there, I mean, sure, that is going to draw you to the study of it, right? Like having that personal experience. But I guess the point is like one doesn't want to become overzealous, but to your point, having that backbone and that extensive experience leading up to the scientific study of it, certainly, yeah. I mean, it's to have somebody that knowledgeable in the topic at hand, it really translates well to the training. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, on that note, like it's, you just, I'm not one to give advice, but I guess like if there is another bit of advice that I would say might be helpful that isn't quite as subjective. Yeah, it would, I mean, that seems like the nature of the podcast. So yeah, if I could save somebody the 5 years of my life that I cut off, you know, like you gotta really more or less get along with the person that you work with, at least on like some level, I feel like. Cause I mean, I've been in lab rotations where the work itself was very interesting, but I just was like, could not philosophically be more disaligned with the advisor. And after a month or two of that, it was completely clear, right, to both of us. And it doesn't mean that like I'm a bad student or the advisor is a bad advisor. It's just not a good fit, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like any crappy relationship. It's a move on. Somebody, you know, like George Mashore is listening. Like, I love you, George. Yeah. But anyhow, please go on. I'm sorry.
No.
I want to answer whatever you got. So
I guess I'm looking more again through the eyes of the audience here listening about the curious to serious element of your practice. It's also knowing when to get serious and how to prioritize. Even if you're really passionate about the work that the lab might be doing, if it isn't the right fit to listen to that call, because it sounds like you really found a mentor that you really enjoy working with, and you really enjoy the work that you're doing. You said it well yourself. If you're not enjoying what you're doing every day, academia, it's not going to be the most enjoyable experience. You know, adding unnecessary stress or negative emotions, those are things to look out for.
Right. Yeah, I do know people that have made it work, like where they don't necessarily get along really great with their PI, but they love what they're doing. And then I've seen people that have, on the other side, have had a great relationship, but are just kind of like, okay, what, you know, whatever about the work. I guess I probably lucked out a lot in that respect. So I don't know if that's part of it. Like, you know, someone's like getting all like fiery with me, I'm just like, all right, man, whatever. Like, sure, you're the boss. Yes, sir. Whatever you say. You know, like, I don't know. I mean, it's just like, this really isn't helping, is it?
This is the exact content that the listeners are dying for. I guess to something that I think piqued my interest on the first time that I talked to you is an end note that we were getting at was that something that you were really interested in studying in the future was DMT and humans. It's like, what ideally, when you pay off your debt and you get the funding that you want for the research you want, like, what ideally, like, would that look like for you?
Yeah, so the DMT work that I did in rodent models was looking at, well, so we looked at a couple of different things, and it was mainly foundational in that it was addressing a certain number of questions that really weren't answered by studies looking in humans in the past. So namely, like identifying DMT in trace amounts in blood or in urine or in these bodily fluids where it's subjected to this peripheral breakdown. What we did in the rodent models, we had the ability to sample right from the brain of a living rat. So we put a probe in the area of the pineal gland and also the visual cortex of living rats. And then we were able to sample the brain fluid from that area. And then we also use some genetic analytical techniques to take a look at the profile of the gene expression of the mRNA in the same brain area for two genes that have been known for a long time or have been shown to be able to biosynthesize DMT. So we put all these pieces together to identify DMT in the area of the rat visual cortex, and then also find activity in the same neurons and also in the cells in the pineal gland, the pineal sites, and in the proximity of the area of the probe that was sampling the brain fluid. So then we just took the brain fluid, and then you could, it's called HPLC, high performance liquid chromatography. It's one of the sort of bread and butter, like, analytical chemistry techniques. And we looked at serotonin levels, which are established, and we looked at DMT levels, which are not as established with this technique, at least like right out of the brain like that. So it's the same technique that analyzes it peripherally. You can look at DMT levels, but we applied it to the microdialysis. So, and yeah, so the genes are there in that brain area in the rodent. And then the levels of DMT we found were about half of serotonin in that study. And it was a fairly large sample size, it was 30 some rats. So yeah, that was kind of the take home. And yeah, it kind of shocked us a little bit too, honestly, when we actually compared to serotonin, it was like, whoa, all right, maybe this isn't as a trace of amount as we once thought it was. It maybe has some physiological role. Well, oh, so back to the human. So like translating that, yeah, that's why I started on this tangent. I figured like giving some background. Yeah, so I mean, how do you translate that to humans, right? I mean, that's kind of a long-term career goal of mine. And, you know, I mean, everybody's so busy, but we have been doing some pilot studies on some techniques to potentially do that. And that will be something I'll be focusing on for some time to come. Because we feel like those of us that are interested in this research feel like the signal we got from that study in the rodents was worth enough to see if the human brain is actually doing the same thing. Because, you know, we just don't know. I mean, just because you find that in a rat doesn't mean you're going to find it in a human the same way. It's probable, you know, that stuff generally scales up, I think. But, you know, rats have serotonin, right? So if they have DMT, humans may have DMT as well because they have serotonin. But that's just, you know, roundabout logic. So, right, that's why you do the science. That's the scientist way. You need to see it with your own two fleshy eyes, right? So, yeah, developing a way to image it in the living human brain is sort of really a bread and butter gold standard way of understanding what DMT may be doing in humans. But yeah, it's a long road. There's a lot that needs to be done in both the human and the rodent models to get at that question.
Did the rats survive the extractions?
Yeah, it's right. So it's non-invasive. Well, it's invasive. They, you know, it's considered non-invasive because they can still move around and everything. But I mean, it's a probe being put in their brain. It's definitely invasive, but yeah, they survive. They're able to, after the surgery, they are able to move around as they normally would and everything.
I guess I was wondering, like, were you interested in extracting or seeing if there was any DMT present in the visual field of rodents, because that was a less invasive method of extraction?
So it's all unfortunately pretty invasive, which is a huge part of the reason that I, you know, to get serious is why I got out of that, because that research is rodent research in general is just brutal and psychologically draining and whatnot. I mean, I'm not suggesting that it oftentimes is certainly for the greater good. Hopefully the stuff that we did will also be for the greater good. That's certainly the intent, but you know, it's a tenuous line. But yeah, you know, we took that research very seriously and the animal health very seriously, and you know, put in many hours just to ensure the best living conditions possible for the rodents. I was involved with the husbandry and everything. Yeah, I mean, you know, I like, for instance, the Allen Brain Institute out in Seattle has like an altar set up for all the rats and mice and everything. You know, so it's brutal stuff. And it was a big push to get me into the human research realm, where things are certainly less invasive and more, also more directly applicable in terms of like an fMRI study anyways, maybe not directly more applicable, but you know, it's, you sort of need them both for things, right? I mean, like there's things like cancer benefits and studies that are unlocking things that are benefiting both humans and all sorts of other animals and veterinary science, et cetera. So it just is what it is. We got all heavy. My bad.
No, it's my fault. I asked a couple too many times, is that less invasive? Like, you should have toned back.
I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely, it's something to talk about, right? It's like an important issue and an important thing in scientific research to address and to respect and to be conscious of.
Most definitely. I mean, it also sounds like coming into this work, you had a goal in mind to eventually work with humans and with non-invasive extractions for data. You said the gold standard or one of your bigger hopes for the future would be that you get to study DMT in humans. And you're looking at new techniques right now. Would you have any trade secrets for the audience on like translating these? You have to get creative because this hasn't been done before. And the reason it hasn't been done before is probably for many, but one also being that it's pretty complicated. It's like, how do you kind of create these boundaries to help you narrow down new techniques you might need to use without, you know, making them obstacles necessarily that you can't hop over creatively? Like, what does that look like? The artistry.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, the way I approach research in general is I'm not like really fancy in terms of like the techniques that are being used. I'm not like by any stretch of the imagination like trying to like pioneer some new technique or blah blah blah. You know, that's for people far more intelligent than me. But creativity is definitely where I sort of. That's where I live, I guess. So basically to like use techniques that are already established to do similar things, but just to try to develop those techniques to answer new questions. You know, so in terms of like DMT imaging in humans, you know, there's a couple of different approaches you could take. And one such being like PET imaging. So that's been shown over the course of a very long time now to be able to reliably look at different neurotransmitter systems in humans. So like dopamine, serotonin, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, my long-term research goals are certainly more broad than just like studying DMT. You know, my long-term goal just in general is, again, to, and it's why I got involved in the pain research, it's to be able to do some of this basic science research on things that I'm super excited about, but also to be sure that there's this outcome of like what I'm doing is hopefully going to help alleviate suffering or help somebody become a better person or just help society in general. So yeah, my long-term goal is to just be a clinical neuroscientist and do research with neuroimaging techniques and also have that molecular background that I do have to fall back on and appreciate sort of the inner workings that are really kind of only explainable in animal models, well, in non-human animal models. I always say, right, we're animals, right? So that much is clear. But yeah, so but the DMT story or research is fascinating to me, and there's just a lot more that needs to be done on it in terms of like understanding if there is some physiological role for it. But that study that we published a few years back showing the concentrations is in the ballpark of serotonin certainly suggests that it may be doing something in the brain for, the brain's like, it's not super wasteful, our bodies, right? They're, like everything's sort of, it's fascinating, right? Like that's physiology coming back, like, you know, all these like thousands of different molecules and things interacting just to keep you in a equilibrium, right? Mm-hmm. And then here comes these scientists, they're gonna figure it all out. You know, get the Red Bull and the pineapple juice out, bro.
You're on like a 24-hour like binge in your lab working, and all of a sudden you're crushing your last Red Bull from the can. You're like, I've got it. Figured it out.
Yeah, we always do joke about that. It's like, well, at least with my friends back in Michigan, I'd be like, if they couldn't make it in, I'd be like, today could be the day, man, where we solve science and you're going to be sitting at home on Zoom.
It sounds like you're on the path towards the future that you're looking to contribute to. How would you encourage fellow listeners that are a few years back, maybe they're you coming back to complete your junior year of university right after COVID, because there's so many students that also took, you know, that year off and really started to learn more about themselves and started to organize, you know, maybe what they wanted to get into. If this happens to be the space and this podcast happens to be helping them onto their becoming, like what few other words could you please contribute to them and their journey?
Yeah. Well, what worked for me is just, you know, and what I've come to find is that, like, just reach out to people, you know what I mean? Just send some emails or some tweets or whatever, and just get a hold of these people that whose work you're interested in. Cause, you know, I mean, I went to like one of the first concerts I've been to in a, you know, very long time, obviously, because of COVID. Went and saw Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys founder, last night. And yeah, he has this song, Love and Mercy, and he was singing that, and it was just like, kind of hit me, you know. It's like, man, the world is like generally a good place, right? Like you just hear mainly all this like crap, right? But like people are generally like trying to help each other, right? And I think that just like reach out to people, make connections, and say, hey, like, I'm really interested in your work, and you'll probably get a response from almost everybody you reach out to, honestly. And scientists are all a bunch of dorks, right? So it's like, what are we doing on Friday night? Like checking our email. So it's like, if you get some like excited person that's like wants to talk science with you, you're gonna do it. So yeah, just contact people.
People see you on Zoom and they think, oh, you're drinking a Corona. You got that orange liquid in that lime. Like,
yeah.
Oh. No, my friends, I am consuming the scientist's honey, the dew of the gods, the energy juice.
Yeah, there's this place out here that like put Red Bull in smoothies, and I was like, hey, that's pretty good. So it's just like, it's so fast, like in the morning, like I don't have time to make coffee, dude. It takes like 10 minutes, you know? So it's just like pouring some Red Bull and pineapple juice with a lime. It's like fast.
I love too how the conversation about caffeine initially started. We're like, yeah, even caffeine affects our brains.
I'm a fan.
I can tell.
Sugar-free Red Bull, though, because otherwise it's a little too much.
Yeah. Surprise, everyone. This is all a Red Bull advertisement. It's actually
we have talked about Red Bull like 7,000 times, right? Maybe they'll like fund the DMT research.
Translational study on Red Bull and Red Bull users. Please fill out the survey below in the description.
have a lab someday, like everybody's like in Red Bull hats and Red Bull gear, like a surf team, like a tow-in surf team or something.
We're not, you know, it sounds like you care a lot about keeping the research in clinical work as ethical as possible, be it for humans and for even rodents. And I don't even mean even to say that it's that they're less or more than humans. I mean that, you know, on a very principled level, like all life should be preserved and protected to the best of our ability, even in the advancement of science and technology. What can that look like? Like, what can psychedelic researchers, maybe listening, the future of psychedelic researchers, what advice or opinion, I guess, have you been able to, you know, structure to keep the practice ethical? Because sometimes we get so driven and passionate about something that we want to see, or we think that what we're doing is exactly what it needs to do, and we're not really checking how our confirmation bias or our subjectivity might be like blurring the lines. Like how do you stay ethical when you're so passionate about your work?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And it is, it seems to be definitely an issue that is pervasive. I mean, for me, it's just like, why would I do this if I was going to, you know, I would rather be unemployed than put a bunch of crap out that makes no sense and means nothing. And that, you know, it's one thing to like to publish something that you think is one way, and then over the years it becomes clear that that's not the case, and that happens quite often. But you know, as long as your original hypothesis or your original data that you put out there is like in good faith that you think that's what's going on, then, but especially in the health realm, right? Like that's scary. Like it's one thing if it's just like basic neuroscience, but if it has some sort of health implication and you know you're publishing data that's not great or that's knowingly augmented in any way, shape, or form, to me it's just like what's the purpose, right? Like if the whole purpose is to understand and come up with new ways of alleviating suffering, and it's all bogus in terms of the data that's being put out, then yeah. So I mean, just being conscious of that, like thread throughout, and engaging in conversations. Like it's a big backbone of most PhD programs where they'll have ethics courses that they teach, and there's entire panels and organizations that are set up for ethical treatment of the rodents in the research and IRBs for human research. And yeah, just making sure that you're conscious of what is completely ethical and what may be blurring those lines and ever going into the blurry part of it.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, what you just said now about the difference between your work being valid when it's published versus, you know, invalidated over time when newer research comes out, and how aligned ethically you were when putting the research out and being in alignment with the Belmont principles, or learning from our past and understanding that, you know, that we need to reevaluate how to cut your losses and how to make sure you're prioritizing, you know, patient health and wellness over finishing the study, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. The study that you were talking about and that we were talking about, that's the biosynthesis and extracellular concentrations of DMT in mammalian brain for our listeners. Yeah. And I'm going to tag the Nature Journal in the description. I'm also going to ask, because you said that that our future listeners that are interested in getting more connected and figuring out the space should tweet and email
because researchers on Fridays are going to answer their emails. Do you have a Twitter? What email can they contact? Because, you know, I feel like you really just put yourself out there.
I just joke around, by the way, like you shouldn't listen to anything that I say. None of it. None of that's the way. I mean, I have a Twitter, but I literally don't engage on it like at all. I just use it to spy. So if you want to contact me, just email me. That's the best way. And yeah, that email is J1DEAN. And that's at UCSD.edu. That'll work.
All right. You heard it there, folks. Is there anything that we might have missed that you want to drop into the podcast before we hang up and I go to bed and you continue drinking your Red Bull?
Well, I was just going to say, I found this like cool drink that if you mix Red Bull and pineapple juice with a lime in it, that's like really good.
Red Bull, like content creators and
media
supporters, are just going to get flagged into this podcast and be like,
come on.
Psychedelic grab. Who are these people and why do they keep, why was our name was buzzed in here 15 times? What are they talking about?
DMT, I just want a hat. I want a Red Bull hat.
Listen, I just want you guys to give me wings.
I think we covered everything. Like I said, this is, you know, more just go with the flow, like what you were interested in hearing for your listeners. And yeah, if I could weigh in on some things and help people navigate their passions and their next career moves, et cetera. Like, yeah.
Like how many times do you go surfing a week?
Not that much. So I'm not very good. I'm just learning. I got a little confident a couple of weeks ago because I was like, wow, I can actually like pretend to surf now. I could stand up on the board and like not fall off. And then, yeah, I got like smashed by a wave a couple weeks ago. It's like, I haven't been in there since. I actually might be going Friday though, but a couple times a month. I'm going to get it. I love it. It's a lot of fun. But yeah, that was a wake up call. I was like, oh, that's right. Like I could get hurt like bad. Oh yeah. That's right. Yeah. Like the ocean like is going
to
win.
Stop it there because it's getting too much. Well, I'm going to say goodnight to our audience and see how I'm going to fix that part up, but I'm going to pause this here. Oh, do you want to say goodbye?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for listening and take care of yourselves and each other. I think that's what Dr. Phil says though. So, but I mean, I don't really like Dr. Phil, but that's actually like a nice thing to say. So we'll go with it.
All right. Thank you all for listening. If you liked our podcast and would like to connect with like-minded spirits, jump over to our psychedelic grad community. And if you're looking for psychedelic studies, field announcements, job openings, and monthly meetups, you can sign up for our psychedelic grad newsletter with the link in the description. Also, be on the lookout for our first spotlight episode. This will be a short one-topic conversation with myself and John Dean about his experience networking in the psychedelic research space. And we'll talk about his experience sending those initial cold emails to PIs and researchers whose work he wanted to be involved in. This episode will be posted on the same mediums as our regular podcasts, and we'll also be sending it out in our regular monthly emails as usual. I'm really looking forward to sharing this episode with you guys soon. And if you liked what you heard on today's podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. I hope to see you back here for our next episode of Curious to Serious.